Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Eugene Monsalvat. We're going to be discussing Alain de Benoist's new book, On the Brink of the Abyss. Eugene, it's great having you back on.
Thank you.
Before we get into the book, can you give some background information on who Alain de Benoist is and his significance for people in the audience who are not familiar with him?
Well, Alain de Benoist is a French philosopher generally considered the founder of the New Right, the Nouvel Bloc. Though he himself rejects that term, it's a misnomer. He sees his movement as beyond left and right. Well, essentially, this movement goes back to the 1960s with the foundation of the Grep think tank for European culture, the study of Indo-European civilization. And it essentially merges a critique of market liberalism with an appreciation for traditional European societies and traditional societies all around the world. Instead of a sort of global domination of liberalism, it believes in a pluriversum of different civilizations living according to their own proper essence.
And so the book, On the Brink of the Abyss, it is published by Arctos Publishing. But it's basically what it is. It's a collection of essays dealing with the financial crisis. So he talks about the origins of the financial crisis, and he also offers solutions in the book.
Yes. Well, he uses the financial crisis of 2008 as a sort of starting point for a larger critique of capitalism. He sees the financial crisis of 2008 as sort of a harbinger of this great collapse of capitalism, this paradigm shift in global economic thinking. So he's offering a much larger capitalism from this one starting point. It simply isn't a solution to the problem of 2008, but the problem of liberal capitalism that has been growing in our society since the Enlightenment, essentially, with the introduction of individualism, liberalism, the liberation of banking, et cetera.
Did the financial crisis of 2008, that was, it was in the United States because that's where the biggest financial center is in Wall Street, but it did have an impact on Europe as well. And you're seeing the current crisis going on in Greece right now, so it has global implications, but the focal point of it is in the United States.
Yes, the dominance of international capitalism has a geopolitical echo with the dominance of the United States. So when there's a crisis in capitalism, obviously it's going to be a crisis of the United States as well.
What is Alain de Benoist's definition of capitalism? I know different people have their own definitions of it. Is he talking primarily about finance capitalism? Does he have a concrete definition of what capitalism is?
Well, it's tied with finance capitalism and sort of the liberation of the idea of usury and credit. But more so, it's the idea of the market, and the market respects no limits. So you have this idea that once you've made profit in a certain area, you have to expand that profit. It's not going to respect national boundaries. It's not going to respect geopolitical boundaries. So it's this idea of unbridled quest for profit that's truly the essence of capitalism.
How is capitalism unsustainable in the long run? First of all, what do you and what does Alain de Benoist see happening? Will the current financial plutocracy continue to get more powerful and will continue in the status quo, or does he predict some kind of a collapse of the system?
Why, there will be a collapse of the system, and it will be accompanied by geopolitical strife, obviously, because the United States isn't going to let go of its hegemony without a fight. But the root of the collapse of the system is simply the expansion of credit and the diminishment of real wealth, wages. People are buying more and more with less and less money, So they're accumulating this unsustainable debt, and eventually they're going to have nothing to pay it back with. And austerity will be imposed on the countries that are unable to pay their debt. The unhappiness of the population lead to instability within those nations. You see it with Greece now, all these riots, and that situation is only going to get worse.
Is the hegemony of the financial elites, is it dependent on American hegemony, or could they shift, or could they exist in a multipolar world? Like, so let's say America's weakened, but they could shift, could they shift their power to, say, China or India?
Well, capitalism necessarily implies a unipolar world because it doesn't respect the boundaries between cultures, nations, etc. So globalization led by the United States and capitalism are essentially synonymous.
What will happen, let's say the United States collapses, will the financial oligarchy be weakened or will they just maintain their power without the United States?
Well, you could see it go not into nations per se, but into international organizations, which it's already becoming. The United States is simply a place where they all live. The financial class is increasingly global. It's this global sort of hyper class of very wealthy people, this jet set, who have essentially no connections with the countries they're living in. But, of course, they live in the United States, London, the major financial capitals. So it could become this sort of international thing, but this internationalism is predicated on the power of the United States, NATO, the United Nations, and these essentially Western organizations that force globalization onto the other countries of the world.
How is Alain de Benoist's critique of capitalism different than the sort of standard leftist or Marxist critique of capitalism?
Why, it has many left-wing influences, but the problem with the left, as he talks about in his last essay, is they operate out of this sort of optimistic viewpoint about human progress. And so they see the sort of elimination of the old forms of life, the pre-capitalist system, as leading to a better world. Also, that's simply the old left with its progressivist dialectic that feudalism will collapse and then capitalism will replace it and then capitalism will collapse and then Marxism will replace it. Now, the new left has completely abandoned even this critique of capitalism. They no longer fight capitalism. The new left has ceased to see the enemy as corporations, the bosses, the capital. They merely care about, say, anti-racism, homophobia, the typical, what we call in the United States, social justice concerns. And this, in many ways, contributes to the same attitude of capitalism, that the sort of new left liberation of individual desires is perfectly compatible with the capitalist idea of individualism. And so really this new left reinforces the capitalist system.
Do you see the Clinton versus Bernie Sanders election? Do you see that as a struggle between the old left and new left?
Well, in many ways, Bernie Sanders is no more leftist than, say, the Democrats of the 1960s. Why, the idea that Bernie Sanders is this communist or Marxist figure is very laughable. But in many ways, he is more attuned to the concerns of the old left than, say, Hillary Clinton, who is in many ways perfectly a neoconservative.
So the first essay in his in the book, it really talks about the origins of the financial crisis, but he talks about how America changed. Originally, America had a system called Fordism, and I think this is pretty much in reference to Henry Ford.
Yeah,
and some people have described the system as a national capitalism. But what happened in the United States before globalization is as production rised, wages increased. But then as soon as globalization started, that changed.
Yes. So the whole idea of Fordism was you pay your workers enough to afford your products. And so between, say, the 1920s and the 1980s, there was rising wages that were keeping up with rising productivity. So when globalization hit, the production was outsourced. The workers were paid very little. You see, like, sweatshop labor, which is basically slave labor. And the wages in the United States, the real wages, began to stagnate. And to continue this level of consumption, to buy products, they had to buy on credit. This great expansion of the credit card and this mortgage crisis that we see, this is basically a result of what happens when wages stagnate and consumption needs to be fueled by creating debt. This has also led to the financialization of the economy because the old industries, manufacturing, et cetera, are no longer present in the United States. Its economy increasingly becomes dominated by finance, credit, all of these large banking conglomerates and stuff.
How is the finance sector able to maintain their wealth based on credit without a strong sector of the economy based on actual production?
Why, they control the credit, so no one's going to call them in for debt. When the financial sector goes bankrupt, we have to pay their debt. Why, the financial sector lends to the government, and then when the financial sector fails, the government gives them money, and then the government borrow money from them to pay off this debt they've accumulated to bail out the financial sector. The financial sector has almost complete political control over the economies of the United States and the West.
Do they have as much control over Europe as they do over the United States, and are there some countries that are more independent or semi-independent from the financial system?
In France, they have pretty much as much control as they do of the United States. In fact, it's illegal for the French government to borrow directly from the Bank of France on the French Central Bank. It's illegal for the French government to take directly from it. So the French Central Bank lends directly to the banks, and then the French government borrows from these banks at much higher interest rates. So within the European Union, especially with the European Central Bank, there is this financial domination we see in the United States.
On a global level, are there some nations that are independent from the financial system?
Iran. And then you see this, North Korea, you could say. And then you see this movement away from the financial system, from nations that are kind of integrated into the global economy, but realize that the United States is becoming a drain. We see things like the BRICS movement, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, which want to create sort of an alternative financial system to the United States. And also you're increasingly seeing countries that want to do trade in their own currency. Why, right now, the global financial system, when two countries want to trade, they convert their commodities into dollars and trade those dollars rather than trading their currency or the commodities directly.
So Alain de Benoist, he makes the point that the idea of capitalism regulating itself by the action of the invisible hand is nonsense because capitalism is dependent on massive amounts of public funding. What do you think about the libertarian argument that what we have is not real capitalism, and if we just remove the government funding and bailouts, things will work out?
All right, well, that's not real capitalism. It's sort of a no true Scotsman argument. So this sort of, oh, it isn't true capitalism. Like, capitalism never existed is a sort of a fanciful wish. But even if we were to let everything collapse, if they still operated under the logic of capitalism, it would come back again. Well, the logic of capitalism is to gain profit without any concern for the public. It's essentially what's good for the individual is what's best for society. And so this individualistic philosophy is the root of capitalism, and it's necessary that capitalism and individualism live together. If you eliminate this individualistic attitude, you eliminate the capitalist attitude and vice versa.
The next essay you talk about in his book is called The Dollar at the Heart of a Crisis, and this concerns the role that the dollar plays as a global reserve currency, which is issued by the Federal Reserve. I remember recently, I think it was this year, there's been discuss of China replacing the United States as a global reserve currency. But what is the significance of having the U.S. dollar as the global reserve currency, and what are the points that Alain Devinois makes in that chapter?
Well, the thing with the dollar is that if it's the global reserve currency, everyone has to accept it at face value. And so the United States can continue to print dollars and not have inflation because everyone is forced to accept it. And they can continue to accumulate all these massive debts and still everyone is forced to accept it. And China is starting to get sick of the United States accumulating all this debt. They know it's unsustainable. They can't continue to feed the United States economy. And so in 2008, China has been sort of unloading its holdings of treasury bonds very slowly. China doesn't want to immediately collapse the dollar because that would render their holdings of U.S. currency worthless. But they realize that this dollar domination is simply allowing America to continue unsustainable credit habits.
And you also have nations, nations like China, Russia, India, Brazil, Argentina, and Iran. They've been pursuing bilateral trades without the U.S. dollar. Are they trying to use their own currencies or one like monolithic currency among those nations that would compete with the United States?
Well, yes, the whole idea of the bilateral trade is that they use their own currency. So you'd be swapping Chinese yuan for Russian rubles, et cetera. There is talk of like a sort of BRICS reserve bank that would have their own reserve currency. That's still in the future.
Do you see it as necessary for there to be a global reserve currency, or could nations exist without it?
I think nations could exist without it. If there was a global reserve currency, it would have to be sort of an average of all the nations taking part in it. It couldn't just be pegged to one country. That would give them an unfair advantage and essentially use the rest of the world as leverage for it. Like what Alain de Benoit proposed for the euro is that within the eurozone, you could have the national currencies, and the euro could be a currency that's an average of the national currencies used to trade outside of the eurozone. With the dollar, you have the United States essentially dictating to the rest of the world. As with the euro, you essentially have Germany dictating to the rest of Europe, and that's grossly unfair for any nation that isn't the United States or Germany.
Then the following essay is free trade and protectionism and how production has been moved overseas, and this has happened in the United States and in Europe as well. So originally, we had an economy based on production, and when all those manufacturing jobs went overseas, our economy is based pretty much purely on credit, and you look at the jobs available, you look at the situation right now, you have young people graduating college with $100,000 dollars in debt, and the only jobs available to them are like retail jobs. But these same problems are happening in Europe too. And I also wanted to ask you, what's your take on Donald Trump talking about the trade issue?
Well, I'm glad that the issue has been broached. I don't know whether he's genuine or an opportunist. I don't endorse political candidates, but I'm quite glad that it's coming back into the mainstream discourse, because the idea of protectionism is so hated, both left and right, in the political class of the United States and in Europe as well. So it's very good to see that topic coming back into the mainstream.
Does Alain de Benoist, what are some of the things that points that he makes about free trade in his book?
Well, citing the work of the Nobel Prize winner Maurice Allais, he says that this idea that free trade is mutually beneficial is false, because if you have free trade across widely different economies, it's going to lead to an imbalance that's negative for both. Like you see with free trade between essentially the U.S. and the developing world. In the developing world, you get these sweatshop laborers and this corruption from U.S. capitalism. And from the U.S., you get this loss of jobs, the financialization of the economy, stagnant, decreasing wages.
And the point he makes, Alain de Benoist, is that protectionism is not just an economic weapon, but it's also a political and cultural tool as well. And he says that if you would institute protectionism, you would liberate people politically and culturally, not just economically.
Yes, because protectionism is ultimately a way of favoring one's own nation out of the international marketplace. So if you would institute protectionism in Europe, European products would be more popular, European television and movies, etc. It would decrease the cultural influence that comes from U.S. capitalism. Why the globalization of the economy is also this sort of McDonaldization of the world, where U.S. consumer staples become prevalent in foreign nations, music and movies become prevalent in foreign nations. And so protectionism is not only a way of protecting the economy, but also protecting culture.
And then the next essay is Death on Credit, and he talks about the perception of usury from antiquity to the modern age. And in ancient Rome, lending money at interest was condemned, as it was by Aristotle, who condemned interest. The birth of money from money, as the most unnatural mode of wealth accumulation. And then it was condemned. Basically, usury was condemned throughout the Middle Ages by the Catholic Church. And then the first major turning point on economic theology was Calvin. And I think in some ways, even though Calvin was from Europe, he had a stronger impact on the culture of the United States than he did on Europe, because I'd say Europe is more Catholic in general. And then after the French Revolution, usury became more prevalent.
Yes, so Catholic social teaching has always opposed the domination of finance, and this is equivalent with the teachings of Greece and Rome, the ancient pagan Protestantism that liberated credit market. And also Protestantism had an impact on the mindset of capitalism, this sort of individualistic idea of salvation, like with things like Max Weber's The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. You can see this sort of Protestant work ethic that has influenced the development of capitalism.
Do you see the Protestant work ethic as inherently a bad thing? Some people would make the point that it's led to America's prosperity.
I think in many ways the Protestant work ethic is a bad thing, because it distracts people from social bonds in favor of the accumulation of wealth. I'm not saying that people shouldn't work, but I think that in many European countries, there's a idea that people should have time to spend with their families, that they shouldn't devote their lives to economic pursuits. Like this Protestant work ethic naturally encourages the economization of all aspects of life by reducing life transactions.
And in the Catholic countries of Europe, there's more of a culture where about enjoying the quality of life as opposed to just making money, which you see strong. It's most prevalent in the United States, but also in other Protestant countries like England.
Yes, it's a very Anglo-Saxon idea.
And the other thing about Calvinism is Calvinist theology, which it really, the Puritans subscribed to it, and it had a major influence in this country, is if basically your destiny is predestiny. So basically, yeah, if you're poor, you deserve to be poor, and if you're rich, you deserve to be rich. So people in the United States have sort of accepted that, and I think the Calvinist influence is why there's been less sort of revolutionary-type movements that you've seen in Europe and in South America. I think Calvinism is one of the main reasons American culture has the attitudes that it does, and that prevents revolutionary-type movements from fermenting.
Calvinism has become, in its secular modality, the basis of sort of American capitalism, this sort of Reaganist idea that, oh, if you are poor, it's because you're lazy or don't work hard or are stupid. And so you can see, obviously, this alliance between, say, fundamentalist Protestantism in the United States and this unrestrained market liberalism. And that goes back to the whole Calvinist idea of if you work hard, you'll make a lot of money. And God has blessed you.
Yeah, basically that idea that people that are successful, they've gained their success through hard work, and that people who are not successful, they're just lazy.
Yes, and the fact of the matter is, on a global level, if you look at the Eurozone crisis, Greece actually works more hours per week than any of the other EU nations. But, of course, since Greece is poor, obviously the rest of the EU thinks they're lazy, they're stupid, et cetera, et cetera. And that structural inequality built into the capitalist system.
The next essay is Public Debt, How States Have Become Prisoners of Banks. It details how states have essentially mortgaged their assets to private institutions, often the same way they've been forced to bail out the banks.
Yeah,
and what happened is after the financial crisis in 2008, the governments of the United States, the UK, and the European Union, also Japan as well, they were forced to inject $5,000 billion into the global economy.
Yes, I believe that's $5,000 billion. I believe that's $5 trillion. Yes.
So that's not just the United States. That's globally.
Yes, that's globally. And so you see with this injection is it's not for free. Why the government didn't just print the money and hand it out. They borrowed this money from the same banks they were forced to bail out. So they're borrowing money from the institutions they bail out for free, and then they have to pay those institutions back at interest. And to pay those institutions back, they cut social services, they impose austerity, privatization, they sell off these assets to corporate buyers for fire sale prices. Essentially, what you're having in Greece is a foretaste of what's going to happen globally.
Book. So Benoit proposes a number of different solutions. One of them is forcing banks to write off debts cured by exploitative loans. Does he propose nations default on their debt the way that Iceland did, because basically with the United States debt, United States debt, I forget the specific number, but it's at a point where it's impossible to pay off, really. The only solution is defaulting on debt. Does he propose that?
Yes, but it can't be an exploitive default. It can't just be we default, but the austerity is imposed by the IMF. Like what you said with Iceland, when they defaulted, they just told their creditors to go away. We're not paying this money back. That's the end of it. It wasn't that, we defaulted and now we're going to have to go through austerity. It's simply saying we're not going to recognize this debt anymore.
And he proposes isolating commercial finance from savings. So that's basically what the Glass-Steagall Act did. It prevented, it separated savings banks from banks that lent money. And then that was, in the United States, that was repealed under Bill Clinton.
Yes, that would prevent any collapse of sort of the speculatory market from hitting the savings of the average consumer.
Was there something similar in France as well and in other European countries, like the Glass-Steagall Act?
I'm unaware of that.
Well, you point out that there's a law forbidding the Bank of France from purchasing treasury bonds rather than having to lend to banks that lend to the state. Oh, he proposes that laws forbidding the Bank of France from purchasing treasury bonds rather than having to lend to banks that lend to the state should be abolished.
Yes, because what happens is that the Bank of France currently, it lends to the banks for almost zero interest. And then the French government borrows from the banks at much higher interest rates. So why can't the Bank of France just purchase the treasury bonds of the French government and directly inject that cash into the French government rather than having the French government pay all this interest?
And he also proposes nationalizing banks, and which are basically where the bank would be a public utility, a public bank. Does he point to successful examples of that, bank nationalization?
Well, he doesn't cite anything I can think of right now. I mean, there were national banks. I believe the Bank of England was nationalized.
You point out that attempts for a petty national economy from the right, which preserves capitalism on a national level, will fail. So you think that, are you saying that capitalism, even without globalization, is still bad? Like, didn't we have the system we had previously, which was described as Fordism, that we had from the 20s until the 1980s, wasn't that sort of like national capitalism? And we were pretty, that's when we had a lot more prosperity as a nation. So you think that capitalism is destined to fail even on a national level?
Well, it's simply the logic of capitalism that it won't stick within national boundaries. Once you've made profit from a nation, you need to increase the profits by going outside of the nation. So simply maintaining, trying to keep it under wraps is maintaining the unsustainable tension. And also, if you preserve the worst aspects of capitalism, I mean, the Fordist system was sort of committed with the rise of security and social safety net legislation. So you can't purely have exploitation of the workers on a national level as well.
And then he asked another essay that he asked the question, should the euro be made a common currency? So is he's for or against the euro being made a common currency?
He proposes that the euro could be reformed on the basis that you have national currencies within Europe, and then the euro is an average of these national currencies that is traded outside of the eurozone. Right now, the euro is simply, it was pegged to the Deutschmark, And so it's excluding all the other countries except for Germany. And it's unifying a sort of uneven playing field. Also, the sort of creation of the Eurozone was very much in line with the idea of free trade. It wasn't a protectionist Eurozone, like it wasn't a unified Europe behind a tariff wall. It was a unified Europe being integrated into the globalized economy. So the euro as it functions has been very bad for Europe, but theoretically, we could have a common European currency that respects the national currency. We still have national currencies, and it would be an average of these national currencies that would be used by Europe as a block to trade outside of Europe. And the European Union would be this sort of liberal free trade area, but a sort of protectionist lock around Europe that encourages Europe to buy European rather than integrating Europe into the global economy.
There's a chapter, the middle classes and the working classes, A Politics of Poverty, and this discusses the growing inequality between the super rich and the rest of society, culminating in a gradual impoverishment of the middle and lower classes. So what's happening right now is that the middle class is being looted by the financial elite, and they're being pushed down to the level of the lower classes. But I think what's also happened throughout history is there's also been a class struggle between the middle class and the lower class. And the middle class has seen the lower class as a threat. And you see a lot of, like, I'll give you an example, a lot of middle class people who are part of the Tea Party movement, their concern is that lower class people will push socialism to confiscate their wealth. And I think that's prevented the middle class from pursuing their own class interests against the plutocracy.
That's a very American problem, which goes very much back to the whole idea that if you're poor, you're lazy and parasitic, that originates from this Calvinist mindset that's so deeply ingrained in America. Though, I mean, in Europe, why there's been different conceptions of the class struggle, why Marx saw the struggle between the lower class and the middle class, but on a different level, there was Ferdinand LaSalle, who saw that most of the wage earners he considered as sort of a unified class, and that there was just a thin layer of capital excluding that.
So if you look at the disparity in income, so in 1980, the U.S. average CEO made 20 times the salary of the average worker. And then in 2000, that was multiplied by 531 times. And then the bailouts happened after, and the financial collapse happened. And the disparities have gotten even worse. You don't point out to what the CEO disparities are right now, but what has happened is there's this emergence of a global hyperclass where you have 6,000 incredibly rich people. Do you have statistics on what percentage of these people control of the global share of the wealth or of the share of the United States' wealth?
No, I don't have any statistics, but it's increasingly becoming obvious that the wealth is becoming concentrated in very small hands, due to the financialization of the economy, because you don't require high skilled manufacturing labor. You aren't really paying the high wages. So this tendency to concentrate wealth is only going to increase as the economy becomes more and more financialized.
Does he talk about any kind of a tax policy of what tax policy should be?
For the most part, I would think that higher taxes on these people could eliminate some of this. But the issue is not so much trying to fix it with taxes, but trying to fix it with a structural change in the economy. Because so long as the Western economy has moved towards finance and away from manufacturing, simply going to be no way to stop the wealth from flowing from the hands of the indebted masses into the essentially global banking elite.
Does he get more into detail about the relationship between the middle class and the working class, and how much of a conflict has there been between the middle class and the working class?
I think to Hollande has been a lot. He sees the middle class and the working class as almost falling in the same boat, because the middle class is increasingly facing downward pressure and becoming more working class. They're becoming poor. We're seeing this downward mobility, where kids are now having lower living standards than their parents.
What do you think about how a lot of Marxists and leftists, how they view the middle class as they call them the petit bourgeois, as opposed to the mon bourgeois, which is the ultra-rich?
Well, I think that's sort of a... Obviously, there is a class struggle, but the idea that the petty bourgeois are agents of capitalism, I find a bit hard to swallow, because they suffer from it like the true proletariat does. I would perhaps subscribe more to Ferdinand Lefebvre, who was a contemporary of Marx, a German thinker. He was one of the founders of European socialism, and he said that all the wage earners sort of constituted a class, and then there were the capitalists above them. So it's more of a dialectic between the wage earners and the capitalists, very much sort of like the whole beyond the 99% thing with Occupy Wall Street.
So the changes that happened, so you put out in this article from 1930s to 1970s, that's when Fordism dominated. It was the growth of industry, and the middle class grew along. Then we also saw the emergence of a stronger social welfare state. And its success, you say that its success was so great that the radical socialist and communist parties in Western Europe and the United States saw their support disintegrate, and then the middle class started to align with capitalism. So that goes back to the point that I made earlier, that you see a lot of middle class people supporting capitalism.
Yes, that's sort of a result of the Fordist compromise, where they see they look back to the period of the 50s with the parity of the Fordist system. Also, I mean, in the United States, the working classes are very much in line with that as well. Not so much in Europe, but even in Europe, things like social democracy have replaced things like revolutionary communism. And essentially, social democracy is a kind of form of capitalism with a strong welfare state. So, the success of capitalism was so great that you saw even like working class people who would naturally be sort of revolutionary agents move away from, say, Marxism or anarchism or syndicalism, all these revolutionary ideologies, and interestingly had a very strong communist party that was a contender into the 80s, possibly because France in many ways was less capitalist than the other nations in Europe, sort of under De Gaulle with the Dirigeant book, and a sort of state-directed capitalism that was prevalent in France until globalization of the 80s and 90s.
So it's really it started in the 70s when the economies became deindustrialized by neoliberalism. So it was really Reagan and Thatcher are the two most important figures when it comes to promoting globalization.
Yes. Why, they are pretty much wholly to blame for this start of unrestrained capitalism. They saw essentially the welfare state that had predominated during the Fordist era as make a grain on society. They also said that, oh, if you can't afford to live, obviously you're a parasite of society. And so the compromise between the capitalists and the working class was broken under them. There was no longer this sort of paternalistic attitude that, oh, yes, we want to help the workers, we want to provide social safety net for the workers. It was simply sink or swim, you're in it for yourself.
And the other thing that happened is that the old aristocracy used to have a disdain for the nouveau riche, and that was strong in Europe. It's been declining in Europe. It was true in the United States to a lesser degree. But what this isn't really discussed, but one trend I noticed is you see, ironically, that the rich is emulating the like pro culture. Like you see like these trashy reality shows where you have rich people who are like covered in tattoos. So the economic system is becoming there's more economic inequality. You see a trend where the rich are emulating the proletariat. But why do you think there's been less disdain for the new rich by the old rich that we saw in the past?
Well, simply, I mean, in Europe, you had this actual little aristocracy. Even in France, even in Republican France, there were people who still maintained this aristocratic attitude. They looked down upon the idea of living to make money. They were very much tied in with the old Catholic social structures, feudalism. So the sort of scratching of wealth was very distasteful to them. But as the capitalist system values, there's been a shift in values that we now see wealth as a marker of virtue rather than, say, an aristocratic title or this air of sort of legality. So we've got this sort of green culture where everyone wants to show how much money they have and they want to show that, ah, yes, I'm rich, I'm better than you. My money has become the moral arbiter in place of things like religion.
And then he has a chapter on immigration called Immigration, the Reserve Army of Capital. And this is a previous essay he's written a while back. But what is kind of ironic is in the political dichotomy is on one hand, like I saw these leftists. I was out at this farmer's market and I saw this leftist group. On one hand, they were passing out flyers saying, crush capitalism. Capitalism is a pyramid scheme. Then their other flyers were saying that let's have a world without borders. Then on the other hand, you get a lot of right-wing anti-immigration types who describe themselves as capitalists. Alain de Benoist says that immigration is part of a capitalist system, and it shows that it cannot be opposed without opposing capitalism itself. And in France, mass immigration was encouraged under Pompidou. Was that in the 70s by several large corporations?
Is it gone after 69 into the 70s? And you had the French-like employers union that created this general society for immigration to recruit foreign labor. Why, they used to send recruiters out into the French Maghreb in North Africa to bring in foreign labor. I mean, the whole point of recruiting these immigrants is because, one, they weren't involved in sort of the European class struggle. The European working class had been developed this consciousness. They had unionized. They had agitated for their economic rights politically. And these immigrants didn't have that class consciousness. They worked for lower wages. So, obviously, they were much better for the capitalists because they made less of a fuss and you could make more profit off them because you didn't have to pay them as much. What's going on in America right now as well, why are you bringing in all this immigration? It's to undercut the unionized labor in the United States. And so union membership in the United States has been dropping drastically as this
huge immigration trend.
So there's that famous quote by Benoit where he says, one who criticizes capitalism while approving immigration, which the working class is the first victim, would do better to remain silent. One who criticizes immigration while remaining silent regarding capitalism should do the same.
Yeah, so it essentially means that capitalism and immigration are two sides of the same coin. If you don't take both on, you're essentially just talking to the wall. It's pointless.
So the following essay is, should a citizen's income be instituted? And there's this idea going around that every citizen of a country should get a guaranteed income regardless of whether they're working or not, basically as a basic right of citizenship.
Yes, that's the basic idea of the citizenship. And coming sort of as a long history, like the ancient Greeks under Pericles, they would give people wages to perform service to the state, so they didn't have to. So when they performed service to the state, they didn't need to lose their income from their regular job. Talks more utopia, Thomas Paine. In the 1930s, you have the social credit movement, which essentially all money that was minted by the state would be directly deposited into the bank accounts of all the people as a sort of national citizen's income. And in the United States, interestingly, it's been advocated by some libertarians like Milton Friedman and Charles Murray as a replacement for the welfare state. Instead of having people sign up and enter all these programs, you just give them money.
Yeah, it'd be a lot more efficient. You'd eliminate the whole bureaucracy. There's different proposals. What's interesting about social credit is that money would not come from tax revenue. It would actually be income. It would be income that's introduced the way it is for the Treasury, as opposed to income coming from tax revenue.
And with social credit, it's sort of a replacement for the banking system, in that instead of the government borrowing money from the bank to relieve currency, it would just print its own money and give it to the people. But also instead of the government loaning to the bank to introduce money into the general population, or the central bank loaning to the bank to introduce money to the general population, the money would be given to the general population directly without the intermediary of the banks, which just adds debt to the still charge interest, which needs to be repaid.
And this would, it would allow people to pursue creative interests like writing, the arts, because there's people who have talent as writers or artists, but it's very difficult to make an income based on those things. So those people are forced to give up their creative pursuits and like work some like retail job or office job.
Yes. It would change our whole relationship with work and the culture, because you would be forced into a job due to economic pressure. And so we'd have more time to devote to the arts and culture. We'd have work that was divorced from the capitalist system, essentially. It wouldn't prevent people from taking work, but it would allow people to choose a line of work that is closer to their passions. And also give people sort of a separate world from the market economy. They could pursue things that are outside the sphere of the market, which would also affect our values as a society, because money would no longer become the arbiter, because you could work and not make money from the capitalist system. The people wouldn't think you were lazy. And so we wouldn't see money as this great moral indicator. And it would change the way we're for a more social way of life, because it's no longer being a sort of cutthroat capitalism. I got mine, too bad for you.
How would you prevent abuses of the system? one example would be the countries becoming magnets for people from other countries escaping poverty. But the other concern would be promoted concerns among right-wingers of that the welfare state promotes like dysgenic births. How do you address those concerns put out against a guaranteed income that a lot of people on the right have?
Well, the first immigration policy could simply be solved by instituting correct immigration policies. I mean, if you have a citizenship income and you simply live to the actual citizen, then obviously it wouldn't be a magnet for immigrants. And you would have to change sort of the citizenship law to ensure that people just can't take nationalities very quickly and easily. In terms of just turning people into, like, lazy, worthless breeders.
Well, the concern specifically, about promote. There's a concern on the right about a welfare state promotes dysgenic births.
Well, yeah, right. It wouldn't, to the extent of your income, it wouldn't impact people on one end of the spectrum or the other unequally. Everyone would get it. So it wouldn't be taking from the rich and giving to the needy. Everyone would get this. And even if, like, the welfare state doesn't necessarily need to promote bad behavior, I think in the United States there's a lot of issues with that. That's perhaps endemic to the United States.
He also warns against idealing the working class as naturally good, like the fetishization of the working class. So the point he's making, just because the working class is being screwed over doesn't mean they should be fetishized or idealized at the same time.
So obviously, all of this needs to be rooted in some sort of political realism. Like, the problem with the left is they have this optimistic view about human nature that we can have this progress and universal brotherhood and this disdain for the past and the pre-capitalist economic system that should be looked at are disdained by the left because they have this rosy view of class struggle and such.
And he really talks about the importance of rejecting the left-right paradigm. But that's why he personally doesn't accept the terminology of the new right.
Yeah, the term new right, I mean, a lot of Benoit has said, I'm more left-wing than Vaud, the socialist prime minister, socialist interior minister of France. Why, in many ways, the modern left is a sham left. It doesn't even care about the concerns of the old left, the class struggle, et cetera. It cares about multiculturalism and gay marriage and identity politics concerns that are completely divorced from the lives of the average working people.
So we are getting out of time. Before I wrap up the show, is there anything else you can add about the book that I didn't touch upon?
Well, I'd like to talk about Alain de Benoist's sort of last sort of idea about confronting the capitalist system, what it takes, what will it take. It will take a sort of unified front coming from all sides of this political spectrum. And he says that the enemy is on multiple levels. So the principal enemy today is capitalism and a market society economically, liberalism on the political level, individualism on the philosophical level, and the United States on the geopolitical level. So there are various tendencies that are challenges. You have Christianity opposing sort of individualism, you have ideas of religion, the old sort of aristocratic society, and also you have on the left things like capitalism and the old left class struggle. And it's going to take a unified front of these various forces left and right to confront this situation. he said, the enemies of my enemies are not necessarily my friends, but they're necessarily allies. I am seriously not a capitalist, but I always support Castro in his fight against American imperialism. I am notoriously not a Christian, but I will support Christians every time they struggle against the power of money. So it's necessary to work a broad alliance with capitalists. And it can't just be left, right, the typical duopoly power game. It has to be everyone outside the system against it.
I would like to thank Eugene Monsalvat for being on the show.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Thanks again. Check out Alan de Benoist's On the Brink of the Abyss. It's available on from Arctos Publishing. That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.